miles out was already substantially covered with homes. The increase was going to come in the rest of Long Island, the 80 additional miles stretching out to the east, 80 miles that were in 1955 still, to surprising extent, the scrub oak and pine barrens and far-stretching potato fields they had been in 1923, but into which Moses was planning to lay not only for the expressway but for extensions of the northern and southern state parkways, broad swaths of concrete, giant clover leaves among the potato fields. The Regional Plan Association was predicting conservatively that the population of Nassau and Suffolk, less than 1.5 million in 1955, would be more than 4 million in 1985. Onto Long Island's potato fields was going to be dumped a population the size of Philadelphia. Without local jobs, this population was still going to be largely dependent on Manhattan, on the west. There would not only be many more people living on Long Island, these people would have to travel much farther to their jobs. The intra-county roads, local roads, mainly north-south roads, of Long Island's two suburban counties were already clogged with their present traffic. How were they supposed to handle the traffic generated by 2.5 million more people? And it wasn't on the north-south roads that the most serious problems were going to occur, but on the roads to the great city to the west. In 1955, there were an estimated 600,000 individual car trips across the city line eastward or westward every 24 hours. In 1960, the RPA was predicting there would be an estimated 800,000. In 1970, an estimated 1 million. In 1985, the last year for which projections were made, an estimated 1,400,000. How were roads ever going to handle such traffic? In particular, how were they going to handle the traffic during morning and evening rush hours? Employment location forecasts showed that in 1985, about half of all Nassau and Suffolk wage earners were still going to be commuting daily to New York because that was where the jobs were going to be. The only difference in the situation was going to be that, because of the deterioration of the Long Island Railroad and the diffusion of population away from its lines, a far greater proportion of commuters was going to be commuting by car. In 1955, out of 250,000 wage earners living in Nassau and Suffolk, 115,000 commuted to New York, 40,000 by automobile. In 1960, according to the most conservative forecasts, there were going to be about 125,000 commuters crossing the city line heading west in the morning rush hour and crossing it heading east in the evening rush hour, about 50,000 in cars. In 1970, there were going to be 160,000 commuting, 70,000 in cars. In 1985, 215,000 commuting, 90,000 in cars. And these were just the commuters from beyond the city line. How about the commuters from Queens, an estimated 90,000 car commuters by 1985, piling onto the same east-west roads at the same time as the 90,000 from the suburban counties? Attempting to handle traffic in such volume by building highways just didn't make sense. In 1955, there were 90,000 drivers commuting from Nassau, Suffolk, and Queens, and existing highways couldn't come near handling them. Now you were talking about adding another 90,000 drivers. The capacity of an expressway lane, under optimum conditions, was only 1,500 cars per hour. You would have to build 60 lanes of new highway just to keep up with the increase in traffic, not to catch up with the deficit in lanes already existing. The Long Island Expressway would be 6 lanes, 3 in each direction. Its maximum rush hour capacity would therefore be 4,500 cars. 4,500 cars out of 90,000. Building the Long Island Expressway, expending on it hundreds of millions of dollars of public money, would hardly make even a noticeable dent in the Long Island commuting problem. Building a dozen Long Island Expressways wouldn't make a noticeable dent. And how about when that traffic reached the central city? The streets of Manhattan and downtown Brooklyn were already jammed, filled to overflowing with cars and trucks. Now you would be piling into them 90,000 additional cars. Congestion in city streets had already reached intolerable levels. To what levels was it going to be escalated? You couldn't possibly solve Long Island's transportation problems, or the city's, by building roads. You couldn't possibly even come near solving those problems by building roads. Trying to solve them by building roads just didn't make sense. Building the Long Island Expressway didn't make sense. But building the Long Island Expressway with rapid transit on the Center Mall, rapid transit that could carry 40,000 passengers per hour, 40,000 passengers who would arrive in Manhattan without cars to be parked, made sense. Says Lee Koppelman, executive director of the Nassau-Suffolk Regional Planning Board, "By the time the Long Island Expressway was planned, we planners had been screaming for years about the need for mass transportation. By this time, the suburbanization, the urbanization in parts of Long Island, had already occurred. We saw the forces, we saw the problems, and we were talking about the problems, and we all knew we had to have mass transit on that road. It was obvious. In terms of commutation, you have to say, how can you make this road work so I don't have to build six more Long Island expressways? And there was only one answer. We all knew that if there was no mass transit on that road, it would be a disaster. Without mass transit, the road was guaranteed to fail before it was built. Mass transit doesn't only mean trains, you know, Koppelman says. It can mean buses. Buses do not have the capacity of trains, but they have enough to make a difference. Every bus, as Koppelman puts it, can be the equivalent of 50 automobiles. And if an expressway is designed for buses as well as automobiles, if one lane, slightly wider than the normal lanes, is reserved exclusively for buses by separating it from the others by a divider, and if the width and turning radii of entrance and exit ramps are made big enough to facilitate their use by the big vehicles, hundreds of buses can use that lane in an hour, theoretically as many as 800, conservatively 400. The capacity of that lane becomes 20,000 people per hour, about 13 times greater than it was before. Designing and reserving for buses two of the Long Island Expressway's six lanes, one in each direction, would be the equivalent of building a new eight-lane expressway right next to it. But such capacity can be attained from buses only if a lane is designed and reserved exclusively for them. If it is not, if buses are forced to creep along in the general traffic flow, they no longer offer the fastest trip that, along with the comfort of letting someone else drive, would overcome for substantial numbers of commuters the disadvantages represented by the higher immediate out-of-pocket expense of a bus trip and the fact that the nearest bus stop might be inconveniently far from their offices. Too few commuters would be lured out of their cars onto the buses to significantly alleviate expressway congestion. If Moses wouldn't build rapid transit on the Long Island Expressway, planners pleaded, at least let him build it with lanes for buses. Moses refused even to consider the suggestion. Making provision for mass transportation on the Long Island Expressway was in many ways not only Long Island's chance, but its last chance. Mass transportation systems work only if they are able to transport masses, people in numbers sufficient to pay the system's cost, to justify the immense public investment that created it. Such systems work only if there is high-density development around them. They do not work in an exclusively low-density subdivision landscape. Low-density subdivision had already inundated two-thirds of Nassau County. But the rest of Nassau and most of vast Suffolk still lay largely unsubdivided, unshaped. Great chunks of Long Island were in 1955 still a tabula rasa on which a design for the future could be etched with the lessons of the past in mind. For these areas, close to 1,000 square miles of land, there was still time to ensure a different, better type of development, a different, better life for the millions of people who would one day be living on that land. But there wasn't much time, With the population of the two counties increasing at the rate of almost 100,000 per year, each year the tide covered almost 5 miles more of the island. If a change was to be made in the development pattern, it must be made at once. Once the Long Island Expressway was built, no change would be possible. Construction of the Great Road would open the entire island to development. As it pushed through new farm country, even before it pushed through the country, as soon as the announcement was made that the push was imminent, that country would fill up with subdivisions. The pattern of development, a pattern too low in density to support rapid transit, would be fixed. And, of course, the land would become too expensive for the creation of the huge commuter parking terminals. The time was now, before the expressway was built, to ensure not only that rapid transit would be provided, but that it would be used by enough people to ease the transportation burden from the backs of all the people on Long Island. It would not be possible once the expressway was built. Build the Long Island Expressway with mass transit, or at least with provision for the future installation of mass transit, and Long Island might remain a good place to live and play. Build the Long Island Expressway without mass transit, and Long Island would be lost, certainly for decades, probably for centuries, possibly forever. When planners proposed rapid transit on the expressway, Moses replied by saying it was impossible, and by refusing to discuss the matter. The chairman of the newly formed Metropolitan Rapid Transit Commission knew from personal experience. Twice, after all, Charles H. Tuttle had had Robert Moses on the witness stand before him under oath, the value of independent investigation of Moses' assertions. Going outside the Moses sphere of influence, over the New Jersey border to Philadelphia and the firm of Day and Zimmerman, Inc., he found consulting engineers who didn't depend on Moses for a living and commissioned them to find out if this Moses assertion was true. The MRTC could not afford a complete study. Day and Zimmerman therefore analyzed the cost and effect of placing rapid transit not on the entire 85 miles of the expressway, but only on a 7-mile stretch in Queens, from Marathon Parkway near the city line, running west to Corona, where the tracks could link up with one of several existing subway lines and follow its tracks into Manhattan. This limitation placed the rapid transit proposal in the worst possible light, maximizing its right-of-way cost, for Queens was built up far more heavily than the less heavily populated suburbs, and minimizing its effect, since while in the suburbs development could still be influenced by rapid transit, with higher densities near the line so that traffic on it would be increased, in Queens the pattern of development was already set. Even in the worst possible light, however, the proposal looked good. One Day and Zimmerman alternative, for example, was to lay tracks down the expressway center mall from Marathon Parkway into Corona, leave the expressway at Flushing Meadows Park, cut across its northeastern corner to link up with the IRT Flushing subway near its 111th Street station, and follow that line, which has ample capacity to accommodate the added traffic, to Times Square. The total cost of building such a line, the total cost of the additional 40 feet of expressway right-of-way, of bridges at grade separations, of electric substations, of 11 large, modern passenger stations with parking garages at the 11 major avenues intersecting with the expressway within that 7-mile stretch, of every piece of modern rapid transit equipment desirable, would be only $20,830,000. Benefits to the public would be as large as costs to the public would be small. Day and Zimmerman calculated these benefits only for the small section of northeastern Queens directly involved and for adjacent northern Nassau County. But even for this limited area, the figures were staggering. From it, in 1955, 158,500 persons traveled into Manhattan and back on an average weekday, 85,000 by automobile, 59,500 by bus, and 14,000 on the Port Washington branch of the Long Island Railroad. The vast majority of these commuters would be able to save significant amounts of money and time, in Queens up to 25 minutes, in Nassau up to 40 minutes by using the proposed rapid transit system instead, based on surveys of the commuters, on analyses of traffic patterns, and on other surveys done in similar situations in other cities. Initially, about 17% of general commuter traffic from the area would use the proposed rapid transit line in the initial year of operation. And 17% of 158,500 is 27,000. 27,000 commuters who now jammed available means of transportation to New York twice a day would be removed from those means of transportation, freeing them for other users. And their own trips would be made vastly cheaper and faster, as much as 40 minutes each way faster. The effect on the jam-packed buses from the area would be dramatic. Some 19,000 of the 27,000 passengers diverted to the new rapid transit would be bus passengers. The effect on the jammed Long Island Railroad would be less dramatic, but still meaningful. Some 1,500 passengers of the 27,000 passengers diverted would be LIRR passengers. And as for the highways, most notably the Long Island Expressway, which the vast majority of commuters from this area would use once it was opened, close to 6,500 of the 27,000 persons diverted would be persons who drove their cars into and out of Manhattan every weekday. These figures were conservative, far too conservative, most planners felt. The figures would, moreover, increase year by year as the area's population increased and as the percentage of the population using the rapid transit line increased as more commuters became aware of its advantages. But even the initial ultra-conservative figures had remarkable implications. Robert Moses was planning to spend $500 million for an expressway that would increase the one-way automobile-carrying capacity of Long Island by a maximum of 4,500 automobiles or buses per hour, during the two-hour peak period by a total of 9,000 automobiles or buses. For $20 million, 1/25 of that cost, he could reduce the automobile carrying capacity needed by 6,500 automobiles and 400 buses. He could do as much for Long Island by spending $20 million as by spending $500 million, if he spent it on rapid transit. And these figures represented the advantages of building rapid transit on only 7 miles of the Long Island Expressway, 7 miles out of 85. No study was ever done of the cost of building such a line on the other 78 miles of the expressway, so much of it in 1955 still open farm country. But the best-informed estimate is that the cost, including large terminals in key locations, would, if the job had been done in 1955, have been no more than $500,000 per mile. Building a rapid transit line the length of the Long Island Expressway would almost certainly have cost less than $100 million, 1/5 of the cost of the expressway without rapid transit. To save Long Island, it was not absolutely necessary for rapid transit to be built into the Long Island Expressway in 1955, but it was absolutely necessary for provision for rapid transit to be built in. The right-of-way for the tracks had to be acquired, and the necessary heavier foundations had to be sunk beneath the Center Mall. As long as those two steps were taken, tracks could be installed on the expressway with a minimum of expense and inconvenience in the future. Fail to take those steps, and, as with the Van Wyck Expressway 10 years before, the expense of acquiring the land, now so cheap, would be enormous. So enormous, in fact, that it would probably be prohibitive financially. By Day and Zimmerman's estimate, $15 million per mile. And politically, not only would building rapid transit on the shoulders of the road require the acquisition of additional right-of-way and cause public outcry from the owners of that land and from thousands of others whose adjacent homes would be blighted by a nearby railroad, but rebuilding the expressway's foundations would require the closing of several lanes for years, causing immense public inconvenience. The cost of making provision for rapid transit would, in 1955, be minimal in terms of the expressway's overall cost. Acquiring 240 feet of land instead of 200 feet and building heavier foundations would cost, for the whole 85-mile length of the expressway, perhaps an extra $20 million. The expressway was going to cost $500 million anyway. For $20 million more, for an increase in the cost of only 4%, you could take the step that would ensure that the expressway would one day be able to fulfill the function for which it was built. Fail to spend that 4%, and the expressway would never be able to fulfill the function for which it was being built. And that money was available. If Moses couldn't persuade the city or state to put it up, he could put it up himself. Triborough had the $20 million readily available. The Day and Zimmerman study, the first independent analysis of the long-term effects of a Moses Highway proposal during the 30 years that Moses had been building highways, represented a serious threat to Moses. His opponents were usually unable to refute his facts and figures with figures of their own. When he told press and public a proposal was impossible, there was no choice but to accept that statement. Now there would be. And if editorial writers learned how simple it would be to provide rapid transit on the expressway, there might well be a public outcry for that provision. Moses knew how to handle threats. While Day and Zimmerman were studying, he started building, getting the expressway underway with $20 million in Triborough funds so that he wouldn't have to wait for state or city allocations. Even while the MRTC consultants were attempting to determine the advisability of making provision for rapid transit on the expressway, Moses was building the expressway without any such provision. By the time the firm reported its findings to the MRTC, it had to report also that the findings no longer mattered. Because of actual construction work done on the expressway since the conception of the rapid transit study plans, the firm stated, placing rapid transit on the expressway would now require complete revision of the expressway plans and the economic waste of the substantial construction work completed. Construction of a rapid transit line on this highway is no longer practicable. Discussion of the question no longer served any useful purpose. Not surprisingly, there wasn't any, at least not any of significance. The Day and Zimmerman report was one of the best-kept secrets in New York planning history. The city's newspapers carried scarcely a word on it. Newsday, the Long Island Daily, never mentioned it. The public never knew of the ease with which rapid transit could be built on the Long Island Expressway. Long Island never found out about the report that spelled out a way by which Long Island could have been saved. The Long Island Expressway was built without rapid transit, and without provision for rapid transit in the future. And as each section of the superhighway opened, it was jammed, with traffic jams of immense dimensions. One man's dream became a nightmare, an enduring year-after-year nightmare for tens of thousands of other men. Year by year, the huge road bullied its way eastward, through Queens, across Nassau County, deeper and deeper into Suffolk. It would take 15 years to build it out to Riverhead. And as each section opened, as each piece of Moses' largest road-building achievement fell into place, the congestion grew worse. The Long Island Expressway's designed daily capacity was 80,000 vehicles. By 1963, it was carrying 132,000 vehicles per day, a load that jammed the expressways even at off-hours. During rush hours, the expressway was solid with cars, congealed with them. Chaos solidified. The drivers trapped on it nicknamed Moses' longest road the world's longest parking lot. Part of Moses' solution to congestion on his biggest road was to make it bigger. By 1962, while he was presiding over opening ceremonies on stretches of the expressway in Nassau County, Andrews and Clark were frantically redesigning stretches of the expressway that had been opened in Queens just a few years before. Even before its eastern stretches were laid down, its western stretches were being hacked up. In 1966, while state highway crews were building it deep into Suffolk County at its eastern end, other crews were rebuilding it at its western end. Construction of a single monster interchange. Its cost $75 million, more than all the highways Moses had built before the war, at the most congested spot on the expressway, its intersection with the Brooklyn-Queens Expressway, got underway in that year. "My God," Lee Koppelman told a friend one night in 1966. "They shouldn't be doing that. If they've got $75 million, they should be spending that $75 million on bus service, building a bus lane and parking areas where commuters could pick up the buses. Building that interchange isn't going to change a damn thing. If you eliminate one interchange problem, all you're going to be doing is shifting the bottleneck east of the interchange, further out in Queens. So then they'll probably decide to widen it east of the interchange in Queens, and all that'll do is shift the bottleneck east to where the widening stops." Koppelman was right. By 1970, on a 5-mile stretch directly to the east of the Brooklyn-Queens Expressway interchange, work had begun on carving 4 additional lanes of expressway out of the grass slopes bordering the expressway. Final blueprints were being prepared for a similar widening for the next 5-mile stretch to the east, and for providing still more capacity by cantilevering service roads out over the highway. The continual construction made the traffic jams even worse while it was going on, and the men planning the highway knew it would be going on for decades. Not only was the expressway going to have to be widened deep into Suffolk, at every point where it intersects with another major road, Moses Van Wyck and Clearview Expressways, or Grand Central, Cross Island, and Northern State Parkways, for example, giant new interchanges are going to have to be built. Although the public didn't know it, improvements under design in 1974 would not be completed until the end of the century, at the earliest. Men who had been suffering for years on Moses Road, who had been trapped every working day of their lives in those terrible, life-eroding traffic jams, would be freed from that trap only by growing too old to work. Long Island planners could tell when the Throgs Neck Bridge opened by their charts of traffic volume on the island's highways. With the opening, the volume, climbing steadily month by month anyway, made a sudden, sharp jump. The bridge itself was jammed, and the traffic using it did not mean less traffic on the Bronx-Whitestone Bridge paralleling it across Long Island Sound 2 miles to the west. For 2 years, there was a substantial decrease in Bronx-Whitestone traffic, and then, inexorably, it began, even while traffic on the new bridge to the east kept climbing to creep back to its former levels. Moses' solution? Build another bridge across Long Island Sound to the east, a huge sound crossing between Oyster Bay and Rye. Presumably, when that bridge was completed, there would be another bridge to its east, and then another and another. Moses would, if he had his way, cover the sound with bridges, as the Tiber was covered with bridges in Rome. The Throgs Neck Bridge at least was 2 miles away from the Bronx-Whitestone. On the other, south side of Long Island, Moses was building a Captree Causeway, a name later changed to Robert Moses Causeway, connecting Captree, the easternmost end of the Jones Beach Barrier Beach, with the Fire Island State Park, whose name would later be changed to Robert Moses State Park. Traffic on that bridge was, immediately upon its opening, so intolerable that within 2 years Moses had begun building another bridge parallel and next to it, and exactly 68 feet away. With the opening of the Verrazano Narrows Bridge, which within 2 years of its opening in 1964 was carrying 21 million cars per year, a traffic level Moses had not believed it would attain until 1980, traffic volume on Long Island experienced not a jump, but a huge surge. With congestion reaching new levels, Moses said the solution was to build a huge new Cross Brooklyn Expressway, starting near the point where the bridge touched down on Long Island. For that, of course, he needed state, city, and federal approval. But no one's approval was needed to enable him to do what he wanted on the bridge itself. He built on it a second deck that would almost double its capacity. Robert Moses was, after all, mortal, Lee Koppelman kept reminding himself, even if sometimes it didn't seem that way. And one day, Either death or old age would end Moses' decades of power. And, Koppelman believed, it would not take long after that day for bus service to be instituted on all Long Island's major highways, not only on its expressways, but on 200 miles of parkways. The young planner cherished that belief until, driving along the old Wantagh Parkway one day, he happened to notice something he had never noticed before. "I was coming up to one bridge across the parkway," he would recall, "and just as I was about to go under it, I noticed how low it seemed to be. I took a good look at the next bridge, and goddammit, it was low. I pulled over and measured it with my arm at the curb, and I could see that it wasn't any 14 feet high. At the next exit, I got off and found a store and bought a yardstick and got back on the parkway and measured the next bridge. At the curb, it was 11 feet high, and I didn't have to go and measure all the other bridges. I knew right then what I was going to find. I knew right then what the old son of a gun had done. He had built the bridges so low that buses couldn't use the parkways." The Wantagh Parkway had, of course, never been rebuilt since it had opened in 1929. Most of Moses' other parkways were being rebuilt to handle the greatly increased traffic loads on them. As he drove back to his office, Koppelman was hoping that the rebuilt bridges, the overpasses that carried intersecting local roads over the parkways, would be higher. But, at the office, when he pulled out the design drawings he had been sent by the Long Island State Park Commission, he saw at a glance that his hopes had been false. The new bridges were several feet higher in the center, over the two fast lanes, one in each direction of the expanded six-lane parkways, than the original bridges, because, as Koppelman was later to realize, Moses didn't want unadorned straight overpasses over his beautiful early roads, and curving an overpass over a wider expanse necessitated greater clearance beneath it. But the clearance at the curb was precisely the same beneath the new overpasses as beneath the old, 11 feet. Most buses were about 12 feet high. They could not use the curb lane, or, because the design of many overpasses kept the rise in clearance toward the center of the road very gradual, the lane next to it. They could, in theory, use the center lane, the fast lane in each direction, but not in practice. No practical bus fleet operator would dare take the risk of hours of delay that would be involved in routing his buses down a road in which only one lane was available for their use. If an accident or an overheated car or repaving or any of the 100 other causes that blocked lanes blocked that one lane, any buses on the road would be trapped at the next overpass until it was opened again. In practice, no practical bus operator would run his buses on any road on which the clearance at the curb wasn't at least 14 feet. "I sat there looking at that goddamn drawing. I'll never forget it," Koppelman says, "and I realized that the old son of a gun had made sure that buses would never be able to use his goddamned parkways." The building of the bridges is an example of his foresight and vision, Sid Shapiro says in his quiet way. "I've often been astonished myself that he was so right in those days, and not only so right, but so indispensably right. Mr. Moses had an instinctive feeling that someday politicians would try to put buses on the parkways, and that would break down the whole parkway concept, and he used to say to us fellows, 'Let's design the bridges so the clearance is all right for passenger cars, but not for anything else.' All the original bridges were designed with 9 feet of clearance at the curb. Later we went up to 11 feet, but that has the same effect. Well, yes, buses could use the center lane, but that's an impractical thing. No bus would do that. Mr. Moses did this because he knew that something might happen after he was dead and gone. He wrote legislation, clauses prohibiting the use of parkways by buses or other commercial vehicles, but he knew you could change this legislation. You can't change a bridge after it's up, and the result of this is that a bus from New York couldn't use the parkways if we wanted it to." A quiet smile broke across Shapiro's seamed face, and he almost laughed as a pleasant recollection crossed his mind. "You know," he said. We've had cases where buses mistakenly got on a parkway. We had this on the Grand Central Parkway several times, I remember. Buses from a foreign state, I suppose, and the first bridge stopped them dead. One had its roof rolled up like the top of a sardine can. Foresight and vision. Apt, if the vision was one man's private vision. Building parkway bridges low was indeed an example of Moses' foresight in trying to keep intact his original concept, the bright and shining dream he had dreamed in 1924 of roads that would be not just roads, but works of art, that would be ribbon parks for pleasure driving. Building the parkway bridges low was indeed an example of Moses' foresight in trying to keep intact his original concept of the area through which those roads ran. Lovely Long Island, as a serene and sparsely populated suburban setting, a home for the relatively small number of people wealthy enough to live there, a playground for the larger but still restricted number of people wealthy enough to drive there and play in the parks he had built there. The vision was no longer relevant. It no longer bore any relation to reality. Reality was no longer a Long Island that was a sparsely populated playground, but the residence of millions of people. Moses Parkways now had to perform a function, getting tens of thousands of commuters to and from work. The Southern State Parkway, 4 million cars in 1940, 20 million in 1950, 26 million in 1955, 30 million in 1957, was the most heavily traveled highway in the entire world, and probably the most congested. Engineers clocking traffic in 1967 found that on the first five-mile stretch of road, from the toll booths in Valley Stream out to Lynbrook, the speed range at which traffic moved during a rush hour never, for more than the briefest of periods, got above 16 miles per hour, and often was as low as 3 miles per hour, about as fast as the people driving could have walked. The parkways had a different function now from that of the great open road on which Moses had envisioned cars breezing along. But Moses still had absolute control over parkways, and whether or not that vision had any relation to reality, he used that control to ensure that it would endure far beyond his own lifetime, long after he was dead and gone. Thanks to his foresight, it was, as late as 1974, decades after the reality had changed, his vision, and not reality, that governed the shaping of the parkways, and that therefore prevailed over that portion of the lives of its users that they spent on it. For how long would it continue to do so? Well, Sid Shapiro had been overstating the case, of course, when he said, "You can't change a bridge after it's up," and that therefore buses would never be able to use the Long Island parkways. A bridge can be rebuilt. When, in 1969, a five-mile stretch of the Northern State Parkway was rebuilt, in fact, it was rebuilt with bridges with a 14-foot clearance, because doing so would make the job eligible for federal funds, and, as Shapiro put it, "On that section, you have the Long Island Expressway right next to it, and buses wouldn't want to use a parkway where they have an expressway, so it doesn't really matter." But that was one stretch of parkway out of 200 miles of parkway on Long Island, and on the rest of those 200 miles, it would not be true that it doesn't really matter. And Shapiro said, sitting there complacently on the terrace in the bright sun, there were no plans in existence to rebuild bridges along the rest of those 200 miles, and he felt that probably they would never be rebuilt. Asked what would happen if bus operators did decide that they wanted to use the Northern State instead of the expressway, he said, "Well, they can use it for a five-mile section, but then they'll have to get off." Never? Shapiro was probably overstating the case. Sometime in the future, surely, the Long Island State Park Commission would be in the hands of men with a different philosophy from that of Robert Moses and Sid Shapiro, and they would want the bridges rebuilt. Maybe not in the near future, for Shapiro's successors as the commission's top administrators were already hand-picked and groomed, but sometime in the future. "Well," Sid Shapiro said, "you see, those bridges cost about $750,000 per bridge. And, Sid Shapiro said slowly, in his quiet, sly voice, there are 204 bridges on those parkways, you know. Robert Moses had condemned to monstrous traffic jams not merely the present generation of users of his parkways, but generations to come. He had condemned all Long Islanders for generations to come. In the 1970s, after the fall of Robert Moses, public officials would be talking about modernizing the existing mass transportation facilities on Long Island and building new ones. Handsome four-color brochures designed to win voter approval for the new bond issues and the billions that would be required to finance these improvements assured voters that the expense would, if not end, at least substantially alleviate traffic congestion on Long Island. But building them wasn't going to be that easy. Moses had been asked to reserve space on the Van Wyck Expressway. Reserving it would, at the time, have cost only $1,750,000, and if Moses had spent that money, it would now, in the 1970s, be possible to construct all the high-speed rail links involved for less than $10 million. In 1968, with congestion on the Van Wyck and at Idlewild, now John F. Kennedy Airport, even more intolerable than F. Dodd McHugh had predicted, no sooner was Moses out of power than the decision was taken to build a rapid transit line to the airport. But because Moses had not reserved space, that line would now cost, not in official estimates, but in truth, $300 million. And even for that amount, it would not be possible to obtain many of the advantages McHugh had envisioned. The cost could be kept down to $300 million only by eliminating from the plans the subway link-up between downtown Brooklyn and central and northern Queens, as well as all local service that would have increased the rapid transit capacity of the Queens to Manhattan line. The astronomical cost of local stations made it impossible even to contemplate including them. Moses' refusal to listen to McHugh had probably deprived New York of those advantages forever. The cost of the airport link, even in its stripped-down version, was so high that no man could say with any certainty when it would be built. The official charged with building it announced in 1968 that construction would be completed by 1971. In 1969, he announced that construction would be completed in 1972. In 1970, he admitted that, as the Times put it, his agency had no funds available to build it. When asked when the line would be completed, he said that he hoped it would be built in 1973, but that it would be safer to say 1974. It would have been safer, and more accurate, to say that he didn't have any idea when it would be built, for that was in fact the case. The money to begin construction was still not in hand. It was possible to predict with some certainty that the airport rapid transit line would eventually be built, if for no other reason than that the cost was within the ability of the Port Authority to pay, and the Port Authority, losing money because of traffic congestion, travelers' eagerness to avoid the airport was considered the primary reason for a year-by-year decline in patronage beginning in 1969, could be expected to come up with the money if no one else would. It was not possible to make such a prediction about the other desperately needed Long Island mass transportation improvements, projects that could have been built with such relative ease years before, if at that time Moses had consented to reserve space for them or to allow Triborough Authority funds to be spent on them. The increase in the cost of the land needed for parking areas and terminals of new dimensions had added tens of millions of dollars to the cost of modernizing the Long Island Railroad. The further improvements made necessary in the intervening years if the railroad was to attract new passengers from the mass of automobile users on Long Island had added tens of millions of dollars more. And inflation had caused these additional costs to multiply. In 1954, when, before the imposition of the joint program, Triborough funds for the modernization had been available, the modernization would have cost $200 million. In 1970, after Moses' fall, the cost was $1,500,000. While public officials talked vaguely about that sum being raised by a combination of bond issues and contributions from new mass transit allocations that would hopefully be made someday by the federal government, in fact, money that would allow expenditures of that dimension on a single rail line was nowhere in sight on Capitol Hill. And even while local officials were trying to find it, inflation and further land development were causing that cost to rise by more than $50 million per year. Home construction on the land around the LIRR lines meant that certain of the changes indispensable for a true modernization program, straightening and elevating the tracks to permit high-speed train operation, were, politically, immensely difficult. No man could predict with any real certainty that improvements of significant scope, not the patchwork supplying of new cars and improvements of repair and maintenance facilities that was going on in the early 1970s, but the transformation of the LIRR into a truly modern 80-mile-per-hour carrier would be carried out during his lifetime. No man could predict that they could be carried out within his children's lifetime. As for building a new rapid transit line on Long Island, no man could predict with any certainty that it would ever be built. Most planners who had studied the prospects felt, as Lee Koppelman felt, they'll never do it. And even if the mass transit lines were built, they weren't going to help the transportation situation on Long Island nearly as much as the public officials believed, or to be more precise, nearly as much as they told the public they believed. Four-color brochures may have been assuring voters that if the mass transit improvements they had planned were built, they would, if not end, at least substantially alleviate traffic congestion on Long Island. But stark, unadorned black-and-white charts, graphs, and computer printouts stacked on tables or taped on the otherwise bare walls in a small cinder-block room, hardly more than a cubicle, in a red-brick building set back off the Veterans Memorial Highway in Hapog, Suffolk County, Long Island, told a very different story. The building contained the executive offices of the Nassau-Suffolk Regional Planning Board, and the little room, down a hall from Koppelman's, was the office of John F. Jack Sheridan, Koppelman's transportation analyst. And the charts, graphs, and printouts, thick stacks of numbers and lines, represented the first analysis of transportation on Long Island. How the 2,500,000 residents of Nassau and Suffolk counties got to work, to the supermarket, to school, to wherever they went when they left their homes. When they went there, how frequently they went there, why they went there by the transportation means they used instead of by some other means, ever done in meaningful depth. One of the charts, a map really, showed traffic levels on the 9 major east-west routes in Nassau and Suffolk counties. From top to bottom, north to south, Route 25A, the Long Island Expressway, Northern State Parkway, Hillside Avenue, Jericho Turnpike, Hempstead Turnpike, Southern State Parkway, Merrick Road, and Sunrise Highway. Various levels were made graphic by different colors, purple for congestion. On the right-hand side of the map, the side showing eastern and central Suffolk County, the map was a blaze of different colors. But in the center of the map, western Suffolk and eastern Nassau, one, purple, was beginning to dominate. And in the left-hand section of the map, central and western Nassau County, there were 8 purple lines. Only Jericho Turnpike was operating with any leeway at all. The other 8 roads had no capacity at all left for additional traffic. Another chart showed, by means of curves representing the relationship between time and distance traveled during that time, the delays on those east-west roads at those levels of traffic. The curves rose terribly steeply on Long Island's pre-Moses roads, 25A, Hillside, Jericho, Hempstead Turnpike, Merrick Road, Sunrise Highway, on which traffic is slowed by traffic lights and intersecting streets. But they rose almost as steeply on Moses roads, the roads built, at a colossal public investment, to free the public from traffic lights and intersecting streets. Moses' modern, rebuilt Southern State Parkway, for example, paralleled the obsolete Merrick Road and Sunrise Highway. The curves showing time and distance covered in that time for each of those roads ran almost parallel, rising and falling together. Until you get out to Wantagh, Jack Sheridan says, there's no advantage to the Southern State Parkway over the Sunrise Highway or Merrick Road, which is a pretty horrible thought. But those charts, graphic displays of the present, were not the most disturbing things in that cinder block room. That distinction is reserved for computer printouts giving projections of the future. Their figures were not transposed onto the charts and graphs, for in order to contain them, the charts and graphs would have to be too big. Some 560,000 cars a day went through the Long Island corridor, crossed the city line from Nassau into Queens in 1968. By 1985, 1,400,000 cars a day will be trying to go through that corridor. The roads available to handle them were jammed to capacity and far beyond capacity, and the load they will be asked to handle will, just 17 years later, be twice as big. There were printouts more disturbing still. Some, for example, dealt with modal split, planner's jargon for the percentage of travelers which can be persuaded to change or split off from their present mode of travel to another, in Long Island's case, from highways to mass transit. The printouts show that on Long Island, optimistic predictions to the contrary, there is little possibility of any significant modal split at all. If travel on the Long Island Railroad was revolutionized, if the railroad was given modern rolling stock, if travel time was cut in half, if new, more convenient stations were strategically located throughout Manhattan, if all these improvements were accomplished, a highly unlikely feat because it would cost $2.5 billion, the modal split induced would be no more than 10%. 65% of commuters from Nassau and Suffolk counties used the LIRR in 1968. Spend $2.5 billion, and you could increase that percentage only to 75%. The numbers are more depressing than the percentages. Some 85,890 Long Island-Manhattan commuters used the LIRR in 1960. Revolutionizing the railroad would increase that number to 156,700 by 1985, an increase of 70,810 riders. The island's population was going to increase by 1,548,000 between 1960 and 1985. The number of commuters to Manhattan was going to increase not by 70,810 per day, but by 81,000 per day. The LIRR's additional riders would not be riders diverted from the highways. The expenditure of $2.5 billion would reduce the load of commuters the highways would have to carry, not at all. The load would be increased by more than 10,000 per day. Even after that expenditure, those 9 east-west roads, already jammed so far beyond capacity, would be asked to carry daily almost 10,000 more cars. And far more than 10,000 more cars, for the above figures were only for Manhattan-bound commuters. Hundreds of thousands of other Nassau and Suffolk residents were going to be commuting to jobs on Long Island by 1985, hundreds of thousands more than in 1960. The daily average of all work trips by all travel modes by residents of Long Island in 1960, work trips to Manhattan or any place else, was 680,020. By 1985, it would be 1,225,500. And the modal split induced among the non-Manhattan trips by the modernization of the Long Island Railroad would be infinitesimal. The number of daily work trips to non-Manhattan locations would be rising by 549,780. The number of those trips by rail would be increasing by 1,420. Long Island's east-west roads, already jammed so far beyond capacity, would, even if $2.5 billion were spent revolutionizing the Long Island Railroad, be asked by 1985 to carry every day not only 10,000 more cars bound for Manhattan, but tens of thousands of additional cars bound for jobs in Brooklyn, Queens, the Bronx, and within Nassau and Suffolk counties. Spending even the immense sum of $2.5 billion on mass transportation on Long Island would not help the highway problem on Long Island to any significant degree. No mass transportation improvement could help that problem to any significant degree. In 1963, for example, Nassau County undertook an in-depth study of the possibilities of fast and frequent bus service. The expense would be immense, the county found, and the overall modal split accomplished in journeys to work, the proportion of transportation to and from jobs now accomplished by car that could be turned into bus trips, would be no more than 5%, and perhaps as low as 2%. Nassau County could beggar itself to provide mass transportation and still manage to lure off the roads perhaps no more than one car out of every 50. And all the trips above represent only work trips. How about non-work trips, all the other journeys, to supermarket, to bowling alley, to tennis or swimming or golf or bridge club, to school, to friends, to movies, to restaurants, to dinner, to doctor, to dentist, that when added together come to a total that dwarfs even the immense total of work trips, and that are, on Long Island, to an overwhelming extent, trips made by car. In Sheridan's office are maps covered by incredible masses of lines representing the total of such trips on highways and streets on Long Island, and computer printouts totaling such trips for towns and villages and unincorporated areas. The complexity of such figures is immense, but the bottom line is clear. The modal split that would be affected by improvements in mass transportation on Long Island is infinitesimal. Highways and local streets in Nassau and Suffolk were handling a very heavy load of traffic in 1960. By 1985, the load those highways and streets would have to handle would be more than twice as heavy. And no improvements that could be made in mass transportation at any expense that could conceivably be borne by state, city, counties, or public authorities could lighten that load much. "You see," Jack Sheridan says, "if we had had subway lines or rapid transit lines, we would have had high density along those lines. But since there was no mass transit, the development took place according to the way the automobile dictated it. And that meant low density, very low density. To have feasible mass transit routes, you have to have sufficient density, and we don't. And, except perhaps in central Nassau, we're not going to for any foreseeable future. Because of the highway, because of the pattern of high highway use developed by the lack of mass transit before, we're faced with this problem now, and right now, we just can't get around it." And it is a problem to which a solution, if there is a solution, lies only in a future distant enough so that sufficiently large areas of Long Island will have density high enough so that putting mass transit lines through them will make a difference in the island's transportation picture. That day, in 1974, seems decades, generations, away. Part 7. The Loss of Power. Chapter 41. Rumors and the Report of Rumors. Highways were, of course, only one field of Robert Moses' activity. There was also housing, most notably the vast amount of housing he was building as director of the mayor's Slum Clearance Committee. And a few isolated but perceptive observers were beginning to notice clues to something very disturbing about slum clearance. For Hortense Gable, it was rumors. Mrs. Gable, a small, painfully nearsighted lawyer, was a reformer with a healthy helping of the reformer's penchant for idealism and the worship of such liberal heroes as Franklin D. Roosevelt, my father's chief rival, and Stephen F. Wise, the crusading rabbi, who had founded the American Jewish Congress, for which, at the age of 34, she was working as a volunteer. Her involvement with housing had begun, in 1948, at a dinner party at the home of the rabbi's daughter, at which, to Mrs. Gable's surprise, the rabbi was the only person present besides the daughter's husband and her own. "I had thought it was a purely social evening," she recalls, "but they told me there was about to be organized a New York State Committee on Discrimination in Housing. We didn't even have the courage to say against. It wasn't until later that this got changed. which was an outgrowth of the fight on Stuyvesant Town. They told me that the American Jewish Congress was contributing space and had been persuaded to do some funding, and I said, "Oh, you mean against discrimination in public housing?" And I'll never forget it. He smiled and he said, "No, Horst.